Imagine a justice system built on rigorous evidence, not gut instincts or educated guesses about what works and what doesn't. More people could access the civil justice they deserve. The criminal justice system could be smaller, more effective, and more humane. The Access to Justice Lab here at Harvard Law School is producing that needed evidence, and this podcast is about the challenge of transforming law into an evidence-based field. I'm your host, Jim Greiner, and this is Proof Over Precedent. This week, we're bringing you a student voice.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to today's podcast. Today, we're going to talk about a very interesting blog post that Michael wrote. So Michael, let's start by introducing ourselves, if you can tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, Laura, thanks so much for having me on. I'm Michael. I'm a second year student at Harvard Law School, and I'm really interested in immigration, refugee, and asylum law.
Okay, perfect. Well, I'm Laura Aquino, an LLM student at Harvard Law School. And well, Michael just wrote a post about, a blog post about immigration and access to justice, especially through accredited representatives. So I guess I was thinking about the Trump administration and its context, Michael. And as you know, when he was running for the presidency, he promised the largest deportation campaign in the U.S. history. And I wanted to ask if you think that this is matching what we are seeing now that we are into a few months into his presidency.
Yeah, so Trump made big promises on the campaign trail about the largest deportation campaign in history. He talked about deporting like 10 million people, or at least beating Eisenhower's record for max deportations. So far, you know, whether you look at it as good news or bad news, that's not what we're seeing. ICE kind of set initial target for about 1,700 arrests a day. They haven't been hitting those targets. They kind of hit it in the beginning and then have just kind of run through most of the people who are going to get deported. There's a couple different reasons for this. So one is just like, you know, they probably had a long backlog of folks that had deportation orders or removal orders. And then you just run through that. That's a finite number of people. The second thing is just a funding issue. You know, you only have so many people in the in these offices. And you can make them work overtime, you can make them work more hours, but you're not going to see a substantive change in the number of deportations until you see a substantive change in the number of people who are going. Now, two things are going to change pretty soon that I think are really salient. So one is a lot more people are going to become deportable in about a month. Temporary protected status for Venezuelans is going to end. And so you'll see 350,000 people lose protection. And then the second thing is Congress is probably about to pass a budget resolution that will give a lot more, probably about several billions and billions of dollars to ICE to ramp up enforcement action. So you'll have a lot more people. So all to say, we're not seeing a huge deportation order right now, but there's good reasons to think that there's going to be a lot more people who will be deportable and a lot more resources to deport them in the next few weeks and months.
Okay, so it seems like your prediction is that these deportations are going to increase. And I'm wondering if there is going to be plenty of people now going into this into the deportation system, do you think they are going to have to face like different issues now, especially if we think about the due process? Like, are they going to face issues like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So over the past 4 years, or the past 10 years rather, the backlog of deportation cases has grown from about 800,000 to just under 4 million. So, you know, that's like a quadrupling or more of the number of deportation cases. There's been a tripling of immigration judges. But even so, you know, you're looking at 5,000 or 4,000 cases per immigration judge. You just think about how many hours go into each case. And this, you know, yeah, trying to get through something easier. It's really hard to imagine that each of those cases are getting individualized treatment on the merits. You know, we talk a lot about immigration judges. There's a lot of kind of NPR podcasts about this. But there's a lot less discussion of representation. Representation is really important because immigration is, you know, probably the second most complex area of law, second only to tax. And it's really, really hard to navigate the system without a lawyer. But the thing is, barely a third of people facing deportation orders have a lawyer. And if you look at people who are currently being detained, like are right now in immigration prison, that number drops to just 11%. So 1 in 10 people have a lawyer.
Wow, this sounds super devastating. And it also feels pretty structural. I mean, most people cannot afford a lawyer. I'm wondering if you think that there is something that we can do about this.
Yeah, and it is structural if all you have is a lawyer, because lawyers are pretty expensive. You know, it's an expensive degree to get, and there's restrictions on how many lawyers there can be and that sort of thing. One thing that's really unique about immigration law as compared to most areas of law is that non-lawyers can do almost everything a lawyer can do within immigration court. So, you know, an important distinction here is they can't go and, you know, work in actual courts, but immigration courts are an administrative thing. And so you can have folks who are called accredited representatives represent folks in court. And so the way that this works is an organization will be accredited by the Department of Justice. So say Catholic Charities will be, you know, they'll submit their paperwork to the Department of Justice. It's like a 5-page form and a couple questions and a lot of documentation you attach. Once they're accredited, they're able to just pick staff and then they submit staff for accreditation. So staff still have to go through a fair amount of paperwork to get accredited, but they don't have to spend 3 years getting a JD and spend a lot of money on this. And the upshot of this is that you can have social workers and folks who are just kind of like would otherwise be paralegals actually showing up in immigration court and at the Bureau of Immigration Appeals representing folks, really, really decreasing the cost of representing folks in access to justice.
Oh, well, I haven't heard before about accredited representatives, and I'm sure a lot of people haven't heard of it. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? Do you think like these representatives actually work?
So it's interesting. There's a good number of studies that showing that non-lawyers can be as effective as lawyers in more routine and procedural areas once they've gained specialization in an area. But the evidence is still a little bit sketchy. Like, we don't really have any comprehensive studies on whether non-lawyers are as effective as lawyers in an immigration context. Most of the evidence that we have comes from like housing court or tax appeals or social security disability appeals.
Okay, this is very interesting. I'm wondering if, I mean, theoretically, all of this sounds very good, but I'm wondering if people are actually using this right now.
So right now there's about 2,000 accredited representatives across the US. Generally, this is understood as a pretty small number. And there's different reasons for why the number is small. You know, some is just the rate limiter of organizations have to be accredited by the DOJ, and that takes a little while. Part of it is also we just don't know, you know, there are 2,000 accredited reps. It's possible that this is expand, but we actually just don't know whether or not they're working super well. You know, we have isolated case studies, like the Catholic Charities of Santa Clara seems to be using this really effectively. And there's a lot of good logical reasons to think that this would work really well. You know, for example, like there is good evidence to say that non-lawyers do just as well as lawyers in routine and procedural things. And also non-lawyers, you know, cost about half as much. They don't have to be, their salaries are closer to $40,000, whereas lawyers are closer to $70,000 for this sort of thing. But we actually just don't know. We haven't had any randomized control trials. And there are real risks here too.
Okay. It sounds like, I mean, expanding this type of representation would be important, especially given how the system is working and all the backlog. So I'm wondering if, like, we decided to expand somehow this type of representation. I'm sure there are some risks involved. What are those risks? Or yeah, if you can think about those.
So I would think about three risks. I mean, one is what I mentioned, you know, that we know that some of these things are working, but we don't know if all of them are working. You know, maybe Catholic Charities of Santa Clara is great, but, you know, in other parts of the U.S., there are people who are using the accredited rep system you know, just exploit folks who are pretty vulnerable and charge high fees and that sort of thing. The second thing is, even if all the existing organizations were really effective, It's not clear that they would work once they're scaled dramatically. You know, it might be that they work really well because right now actual attorneys are supervising their work really closely. But if there were more of them, then they wouldn't be supervised as closely and it wouldn't work as well. And then third, there's always just kind of a concern about fraud. You know, immigration fraud is a real concern because, you know, folks often falsely claim legal expertise. And there's a valid concern that once we expand the number of people who can appear in immigration court, we'll also expand the number of people falsely claiming expertise. And it's also just important to remember, these are really high stakes proceedings, right? Like people are getting deported, often back to situations where they might face violence or persecution or abuse.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about significant risks here. Do you think there is a way we can mitigate those risks?
So I think the big thing is just assessing the efficacy of existing programs and looking at their efficacy at scale. The difficulty right now in looking at the data is that there's just too many variables to control for, right? Like observational studies, comparing to lawyers and non-lawyers are really problematic because there's just different cases going to non-lawyers versus lawyers. But one thing that we could do is just standardize, randomize it. So, you know, all of these immigration firms have more people coming in than they can possibly provide legal services to. They could randomize things such that, you know, one person gets a lawyer, one person gets an accredited rep, and one person doesn't get representation. Then you control, you track outcomes for each of them. So you look at, you know, what was their sense of procedural justice? Did they get detained? How long did they spend in detention? Did they get deported? And see, you know, is there really a substantial difference between lawyers and accredited reps? And even if there is that, you know, is there still a difference between accredited reps and people who aren't facing getting any representation?
When you are mentioning these cases, I'm thinking that some of them, I'm sure they have a high level of complexity. So I'm wondering if diverting these type of complex cases away from lawyers, it's going to create an ethical concern.
Yeah, I think there's really valid ethical concerns here. So at least the way Catholic Charities does it, non-lawyers and lawyers are taking very different cases. You know, lawyers are taking things that are going up on appeal that involve really thorny legal issues that are just pretty complex. And non-lawyers are taking the more routine cases that aren't as complex and aren't as, you know, are more kind of just paperwork heavy. If that's the case, then yeah, there's real ethical concerns about sending, you know, a really thorny, complex, legally complex case to a non-lawyer and a pretty procedural, straightforward case to a lawyer. But that's not always the case. There's a lot of cases that are coming in that genuinely could go either way. And there's a lot of just like routine procedural work that lawyers end up doing. And so I think within that subset, you could pretty ethically randomize cases. But it's hard to know for sure what is, you know, within and without that subset. So it's a real design question for anyone who would be studying this systematically.
I guess you're mentioning like the randomization of these cases, and it seems like it's an ideal way to really obtain information about whether this representation works or not. But I'm also thinking that these type of experiments or RCTs cost a lot of money and also take a lot of time. Do you think it's worth it given the rapid rate of deportations?
Well, I mean, the saving grace in this is that we do have a little bit of time. It takes time for ICE to ramp up deportations. It takes time for them to add staff. You know, they have to build new facilities in order to expand detainments. These things will take a little bit of time. And so we do have some time to kind of study it and come up with the right response. Now, as to the second question, you know, is this worth the money? I would just think about it as a fixed versus a variable cost. So the RCTs cost money. Say it costs, you know, $300,000 to do this study. If you kind of figure this out once, then you've largely figured out a model that works. And then on each time where you have an accredited rep instead of a lawyer, you're saving about $30,000 a year. That's the salary difference between the two. And you're doing that largely indefinitely. And also the program, you know, if the RCT comes back positively, can expand massively. And so what you're seeing is like a single fixed time cost But you know, you'd be able to serve 30% more individuals indefinitely, and on that basis, I would say it's, you know, this is a huge ROI, like a real return on investment.
Okay, thank you so much, Michael, for all of these insights. Sounds like it could work. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Proof Over Precedent is a production of the Access to Justice Lab at Harvard Law School. Views expressed in student podcasts are not necessarily those of the A to J Lab. Thanks for listening. If we piqued your interest, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Even better, leave us a rating or share an episode with a friend or on social media. Here's a sneak preview of what we'll bring you next week.
One of the biggest themes from my work prior to law school was seeing how the demand for immigration representation far outpaced the supply. So yeah, just to give you an idea of that, at one job I had at 9 a.m. on Monday mornings, we opened intake for consultations for that week. And most weeks we had to close intake by 9:05 a.m. So through this prior work, I have known about these information programs that are targeted towards helping people navigate the complexities of immigration proceedings for those who are not lucky enough to get a lawyer. But I wanted to highlight these programs and look into what evidence is already out there about their efficacy.